All right, KISS Army, welcome to the KISS FAQ podcast. Thank you for giving us your time today and letting us into your head. I hope we don't do any damage. We're just a bunch of KISS fans, and we talk KISS. So come along for the ride. You've got nothing to lose. Join the KISS FAQ YouTube channel. Member perks include exclusive song story demo bites, songs of the moment with contextual introductions, document and merchandise dives, KISS FAQ board topic reaction videos, early access to channel content, and hopefully lots more. Click the join button on the KISS FAQ YouTube channel or follow this link. Welcome to the KISS FAQ podcast. I'm your host, Julian Gill, and today we have a special guest, the author of the new book, Creatures of the Screen, John Harrison. Thank you for staying up late to join me to talk about your new book, John.
My pleasure, Julian. Actually, I should thank you for being up so early. I believe it's 4 a.m. over there, and it's only 9 p.m. here, so yeah, not exactly the wee hours as yet.
No, I'll take the 4 a.m. anytime over 9 p.m. Nothing good happens after dark, so I'm out of the equation at that time of day. Well, you've published the new Creatures of the Screen book, and it's just come out. Who's your publisher, and where can people find it before we start talking about it?
Sure. So it's published by Bear Manor, who are American-based, but they pretty much have, like a lot of independent publishers, they have, like, printing facilities in every country now, so you can pretty much order it and not have to, you know, wait for, you know, long delivery times or pay exorbitant postage costs. So you can either order it directly from Bear Manor, which is just bearmanor.com, or Amazon in your individual region. I believe it's available in most countries at this point in both softcover and hardcover. And I believe a Kindle edition will come out at some point. But obviously, you know, some people are adverse to Amazon, which is fine. So, yeah, they can go to Bear Manor Direct or, you know, I think some of the other book platforms that sort of offer these independently published, small publishers, you know, offer those books. And I think that's a great thing about print on demand. One of the positive things is that it has made a lot of these books so much easier and so much more affordable, especially considering, you know, the exorbitant postage rates these days on a big book, you know, it just gets too restrictive for a lot of people, and understandably so.
Well, you're Australian, so you know all about high shipping prices, because everything pretty much has to be shipped into Australia from the rest of the world. And the postage rates to get anything to Australia are outrageous, as I know as a bookseller. And you're absolutely bang on about print on demand. None of my works would exist or be available without print on demand, because there's no print house niche enough to take on any of my stuff, which is just the way of the world. One thing I like to do whenever I have someone on who's got a new KISS-related book out is just ask you a little bit about your fandom and, you know, your road into, you know, doing a book about KISS, and what started out for you? What was your Ed Sullivan moment, to use a TV reference, to start this conversation?
Sure, well aware of Ed Sullivan over here, so yep, definitely get the reference. I guess, as I discuss in the introduction to my book, you know, it all started for me back in late 1976 when I was 12 years old, and there was a big party at my family's home for the engagement of my older sister, Carmel, to her boyfriend, now husband, Stephen. And, Stephen had brought along some of his records from his place to play on our family stereo during the engagement party. And obviously I was too young to drink or any of that sort of stuff, though I did have my first beer buzz that night. But far more important was I was looking through the stack of records that Stephen had brought over, and there was all these bands like Fogat that I'd never really heard of, and a couple like Lou Reed that I'd vaguely been aware of. And then suddenly Kiss Alive just came out of the pile and just like struck me in the, you know, like a lightning bolt, like who the hell are these? You know, are they even guys? I didn't know if they were guys or if Ace was a girl, you know. And I remember just opening it up and seeing all the notes, and then, you know, looking at the back cover and just this sea of people with the KISS sign. And then I remember looking up and seeing Stephen coming towards me, and my first thought was, oh, he's going to tell me off for looking at touching his records. But instead he got really enthusiastic and said, oh, you found the KISS record. He goes, this band's great. You know, they told me all about the stage show. And one thing I always stuck in my mind from that night was him telling me, oh, you you know, and they have to go behind the amplifiers to like breathe from oxygen tanks, you know, because there's so much smoke and explosions. And I'd never really read that like in the years since. I'm like, where did he hear that from? Was it something that he just made up in his own fandom or an urban myth? You know, it sounds like something that could happen, but it's just something that I never, you know, you hear about all the minutiae of KISS shows over the years these days. I never really hear the story about them having to go behind the speakers to, you know, suck down on oxygen because of all the smoke. But it was a good story. And, you know, again, he put the record on and it just automatically captured my attention. And the following day, as the party had cleared out and Stephen had left his records behind, so I just sat there while everyone nursed their hangovers. I sat there with the headphones on, just playing Kiss Alive over and over and just hearing that drum solo with Paul's rap. It was, you know, it was incredible. And I was like already like a big horror movie fan, a big science fiction fan, a comic book fan, you know, and I was just starting to take notice of music, you know. So I was really at that point where I'm just starting to like look for my band as such, you know, and Kiss came along just at the right time. I was already sort of a bit attracted to the glam rock stuff because my older sisters were into bands like Sweet and Slade and, you know, David Bowie. So I had Alice Cooper, so I was sort of aware of those. But, you know, when you're 12, you know, and just finding yourself, you want to find your band, you know, that your older sort of siblings don't sort of share or don't get.
Yeah, it's quite a stack of records, Foghat and Kiss in one shot. That's one and very 1970s shot of Americana.
There was also some AC/DC who were a big band at the time, and he was also big into a local band called the Colored Balls, who were like a skinhead band. So there was, you know, a lot of obscure stuff thrown in with the Kiss Alive.
Well, being Australian, isn't being an AC/DC fan mandatory?
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yeah. Actually, my older sister went out with Bon Scott a few times when they were first starting out here, just playing like small clubs. She got to meet him and they went out on a date a few times. And I've got a photo of her sitting in the AC/DC tour bus next to Bon Scott. And it's always a big sort of a talking point at family reunions and Christmases because I'm always, you know, saying to my sister, what was he like? What did he really do? And she'd just say, oh, he was just, you know, a total gentleman. And I'm like, oh, not sure I believe that, but it's a great a story to tell, you know, that your older sister dated Bon Scott at one point.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. You know, going back, that's 76. I mean, that's very early on for Australia and Kiss because there wasn't much of a relationship between the band and the country at that time. They'd been with Astor Records, you know, from 75. After that moment, what was your perception of Kiss in Australia, you know, before Kissteria in 1980 or Dynasty in 79?
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting to look back because when you look at the Australian charts, you know, you can see that Kiss Alive did actually, you know, chart over here. The live single of Rock and Roll All Night, like, dented the top 20. You know, there were talks about them touring as early as 1976 in, you know, some of the local music magazines. And I've got Australian music magazines like Ram and Duke from 1976, 77 that have big cover articles on Kiss. So, you know, they were certainly like a well-known cult level band, I think, at that point. You know, certainly I'd never heard of them until I saw, you know, that record that my future brother-in-law brought over. But, you know, I think they had obviously had a bit of chart success and a bit of media coverage at that point. And, you know, pretty much I think for the next year or so, you know, I followed the traditional. I was into like lots of different things, but, you know, I slowly started getting the back catalog, which was about, you know, four or five studio albums and two live albums at that point. So it was already like getting to be quite a discography for a kid to try and collect. You know, my brother-in-law taped some of his records. Apart from Alive, he also had the debut album. And then they brought me a copy of Love Gun for Christmas, as well as a Destroyer t-shirt. So that sort of started off on the, you know, the fandom. And you know, I think, again, for about a year or so, it was just like, wow, this is a really cool band, you know, like listening to them. And you'd talk to a few friends at school and there'd be the occasional, like, dotted person somewhere that usually had, like, an older brother like me or, you know, an older cousin or something that knew them and had gotten to them that way. But, you know, I think the big change for me, as I could see it, was in early 1979 when during the Christmas sort of 78, 79 school holidays, we used to have a TV show called National Sounds Unlimited, which would air on a Saturday morning, a three-hour music television hosted by Donnie Sutherland. And he would just like play clips and talk music news interviews and all that. And during the Christmas shutdown period, he'd put together like little specials to play just to fill in, you know, the time slots till the series came back. And that early 1979, one of the specials he did was one on Kiss, where he showed the essentially it was like the Live in Japan special from 1977. And in that, he also added like the Alive 2 promo footage. And then in between like each sort of slot of songs, he'd come in and talk about each member and show the solo albums and talk about each solo record and the style and everything. And I think that was something that I remember like a couple of weeks later when school resumed and everyone in the schoolyard seemed to be like really abuzz with it. It was like, oh, I saw that band that you were telling me about, you know, did you? Well, it was amazing. So I think even like, you know, prior to Dynasty, there was kind of like this expectation growing in Australia that the next Kiss album was perhaps going to be the one that would finally maybe, you know, break them big over here. But I think the thing is, you know, when 6 months later, when Dynasty came out, no one expected it to go in that direction that it did with the, you know, the more sort of pop rock oriented sound. So I think, you know, Dynasty over here caught that sort of rising tide that were, you know, getting turned onto them slowly thanks to that Donnie Sutherland special and such. But it also caught the, you know, an unexpected audience with all the younger sort of pop and, you know, teen audience. And I think that combined is what really sort of made that album so huge over here. And sure, it left a lot of the older fans, you know, gave up on them. Even my brother-in-law, you know, by Dynasty, you know, he'd given up on them himself. So, you know, definitely that did drive a few people away. But I think the amount of people that it brought on more than compensated for that. You know, it was really only like maybe 2 years later when the fallout began that they really sort of missed, you know, that dedicated sort of early hard rock audience, you know, because your teen audience, they'll stick with you for like a year and a half, but they're bound to find something else pretty quick.
Yeah, Kiss certainly had those phases in its career. Destroyer drove away the pre-Alive fans. You know, Dynasty drove away the pre, you know, Love Gun and Alive 2 fans. And then the Elder killed off the rest of them. So, over there with the Elder and post Kissteria, you know, what does that do for you as a fan?
Well, exactly. I mean, yeah, like, during 1980, that whole build-up, you know, the media and the record company and all that, everyone was, like, pushing Kiss as, like, the biggest thing, not just in music but in entertainment, you know, and everyone, like, swallowed it. Obviously, this was before the internet, you know, but that's one of the things that I find so interesting when I look back on it now about that period is how huge they were over here versus how, like, slow they had sunk in America. You know, and that was something we never really heard about over here. You know, it was never dwelt upon. I'm sure, like, certain people knew if you're in the record industry and that, but I remember even a lot of the articles written by people that hated Kiss, you know, none of them, they still wouldn't say, oh, they're not even popular anymore in America. You know, it was something that, you know, they built up this fantasy of just them being the biggest thing in the world, and obviously nothing can live up to that when it finally gets here. So I think, you know, in some regards, I think the backlash was already sort of started before the tour even ended, you know, because the merchandise was already getting discounted, you know, while the tour was still going. And, you know, I know the last couple of concerts, you know, there were still plenty of tickets left. And but, you know, it was still a shock after the tour, which was like October 1980. And in January 1981, I went on a family vacation to America with my mum, my mum's friend, and her son, who was about a year older than me. And, of course, the first thing I thought about was, oh, wow, I can't wait to see all the cool Kiss shit that's going to be on sale in America, because Australia was just flooded with it in 1980. I'm like, if Australia's got stuff, I can only imagine how much great stuff Kiss are going to have. And, you know, I got over there and there was just nothing, like literally nothing. And I think the only Kiss thing I found over there was I went to Tower Records and picked up a couple of albums that I was still missing, which I could have gotten in Australia anytime anyway, but it was still kind of cool to be buying them at Tower Records. And I think maybe I found the latest issue of 16 magazine, which was pretty much the only American magazine still bothering with Kiss at that point. But I was really shocked. I was like, my God, there's like nothing. No. I was even like, I'd be wearing my Kiss T-shirt, you know, the Australian ones, thinking, oh, how cool are people going to think I am when they see me in a Kiss T-shirt they've never seen before? I never saw a single Kiss T-shirt walking around on anyone. You know, I never got a, hey, go, yeah, Kiss, they're great, you know. The same time, I never got a Kiss suck, so I guess that was a positive. But yeah, it was definitely like a rude awakening. And
well, not if you're Gene Simmons, the worst thing is to be ignored. True, you know, to get no comment whatsoever is better. You know, which is better, to get a comment or an insult or no comment? I think Gene will take the insult any day of the week.
Oh, yeah, at least that shows you're not forgotten. But yeah, then The Elder came out, and you know that, like, I think we're probably one of the few countries where it did at least chart, but I think it like nudged the top 10 for like, you know, 1 week, and then it was gone. And, you know, compared to like 2 years earlier, Dynasty was like the second highest selling album in Australia for 1979. So yeah, it was definitely a whirlwind. But, you know, to live through it though, to be like a, you know, 15, 16 year old kid during that period in Australia, being a Kiss fan, was definitely magical. You know, it's no exaggeration to say it was, you know, just like a Beatlemania, certainly a Beatlemania for sort of my generation of rock fans, in terms of Kiss just being absolutely everywhere, you know, not just on the entertainment magazines, but on every, you know, even women's magazines, newspapers, you know, on current affairs shows, just anything. It was just a total. And then suddenly it was just gone. It was like just a deafening sort of silence.
Yeah, Kisteria burned hot and burned fast, and yeah, it still remains that, you know, from the outsider perspective, obviously I'm British, so it's impossible to understand that level of hysteria while we had the Beatles. So, but, you know, for the Australian fans, it seems to be that core moment in their identity for many of them who became a fan and lived through Kisteria. And it's just an amazing thing to, I guess, to have for your country, to wave your flag and say, well, we had Kisteria while you guys had forgotten Kiss. So what takes you from being just a fan of music to taking on a project of the scope of Creatures of the Screen? You're a madman. What made you do it, John?
Well, I mean, I've obviously been a writer for like 20-odd years, 30-odd years now. So, you know, certainly written quite extensively over the last 20 years especially. In my early days, like in the 90s, early 2000s, when I was just trying to get started and get some credit, you know, I did write for some Kiss-related fanzines and rock fanzines. It would mainly be like reviewing bootleg video cassettes of some of the, you know, shows from the Alive Worldwide Tour or the Psycho Circus Tour, things like that. I'd done a couple of articles on Kiss memorabilia for a couple of like collectible magazines over here. And then about 2018, I wrote, there's an American cult film magazine called Wang's Chop, and I wrote a fairly in-depth article for an issue of that on Gene Simmons' acting career during the 80s, so his exploitation movie career. And that went down really well and got some good reception. So, you know, that sort of like dipped my toe into Kissploitation on film as such. And then I guess about just before December 2022, I guess it was, I was sitting down and I happened to catch the classic Chips episode, Rock Devil Rock, featuring Donny Most as Morlock, the shock rocker, obviously Gene Simmons' inspired character. And watching that, it sort of struck me. I was like, wow, you know, this is actually more blatant ripoff of Kiss than I remembered it being. And then I remembered, I also remember there was like a Scooby-Doo episode where there was like a Kiss type villain. So, you know, I then sort of sought that out. And then that led me to, you know, looking at the Love Boat episode with Sonny Bono as Deacon Dark, you know, playing a very Gene Simmons-like character. And I kind of thought that's interesting because he sort of takes on this role right about the same time Gene, the real Gene, is starting to date his ex-Cher. And, you know, I wonder what's going on there. Is that just pure coincidence, or is Sonny trying trying to infer something. But I think just as I saw more and more stuff that was like obviously inspired by KISS, I thought this would be a good follow-up article to the Gene Simmons one. And then I sort of thought, oh, well, you know, there's really too much for it to just be another article. So why not just make it a book just looking at everything that KISS has done or and also influenced in terms of film, TV, you know, home video. And essentially just snowballed from there. You know, Bear Manor sort of gave me the go-ahead straight away with the idea. And, you know, I took some time off work. So I do sort of work as well, you know, the day job. So I took a bit of time off to be able to concentrate on it. So it was about 2.5 years of writing. But I suppose, you know, the gestation of it is always, you know, in the back of your head for a while before that.
Yeah, so the book's really divided into a bunch of different sections. Why don't you talk about some of those different sections? Because it starts out with, you know, videos, you've got TV, you've got the appearances, you know, there's a plethora of different subjects that the book is divided into. What are some of those, you know, that's it's important for people to know are in the book?
I think that it's made basically, I guess, the first section of the book is almost like my version of the history of KISS as told primarily through the eyes of their film and TV and, you know, home video, music video work. And then there's a section that goes off into like the documentaries that have been made about the band, both, you know, the official as well as the fan-made documentaries and unauthorized documentaries like KISS Loves You and Andrew Scambetti's work and Necromonium. And then we go into the what I call the real KISSploitation, you know, the films and TV shows that weren't related to KISS, but KISS obviously had some major influence on in terms of the characters or the storyline. And there really is quite a lot of those. Everything, you know, I start with Phantom of the Paradise, which may not be, you know, directly KISS influenced because they both sort of came out around the same time. So there's Brian De Palma's always denied sort of knowing about KISS, but, you know, there was also other, you know, evidence that shows that Brian De Palma and Bill Aucoin perhaps knew each other and hung out together sort of around that time. So who knows, you know, but, and again, it runs a gamut from things like, you know, the 1977 porn film Devil Insider, which has a devil with Gene Simmons makeup and a fairly large appendage that can't do much, unfortunately for him. And you got the Flintstones, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, the episode where, you know, a favourite band of theirs are coming in, or a favourite band of their bosses is coming into town, and they're obviously a very KISS-like band with their makeup on, and, you know, they've got to try and Fred and Barney have got to try and impersonate them to make the boss happy. So, you know, there's a whole gamut of that KISSploitation. And then another section of the book is I kind of open it up to just some of my friends to write about a KISS-related subject, whether it was like obscure or well-known, and had those like contribute. So, you know, I've got people doing things like looking at the Tomorrow Show, infamous Tomorrow Show appearance from 1979. And I've got another friend that donated an interview with Gordon Hessler talking about KISS Meets the Phantom of the Park, which hadn't previously been published, only a small excerpt had, because obviously Gordon died a few years ago, unfortunately. And then, you know, people like Lee Gambin, my friend, who sadly passed away just last year, and the book is dedicated to him, did a couple of pieces, you know, looking at connections between, like, KISS and Godspell, and looking at the use of Always Made for Loving You on the soundtrack to Endless Love. You know, so I was kind of like leaving that section open to just people to propose any kind of, like, you know, idea that I thought might be interesting.
Yeah, I think it's content like that which really helps bring the book alive from just being a dive into maybe some of the media stuff. I like Brett Bartlett's contribution, his essay there as well.
Brett was almost like the envy of most kids, you know, back in the Kisteria days because, you know, I remember, like, reading about him way back then because, you know, he sort of wrote to Eric Carr to welcome him to the band and, you know... A couple of weeks later, not only got a response from him direct from Rome, but, you know, got an invitation to, you know, meet them backstage. So it's, you know, to a 16-year-old kid at the time, you're like, wow, you know, the luckiest kid alive. And I remember seeing photos of him in a couple of magazines at the time, you know, not knowing that many years later I'd be like, you know, basically friends with him.
No, that's amazing. And that just showed how open the band could be at times. I mean, obviously, Eric Carr was a very special human being and very appreciative of his fans. But there were periods in time where all band members, you know, you have Bill Baker interviewed in that, and he had a relationship that was quite close with Ace at one point. So it's nice to see him get to recount some of those stories as well. You've got Carl V. Dupre. Which I thought was very brave. Anything touching on that era of Kisstory is quite divisive to fans. So it was nice to have that represented and for you to be delving into, you know, some of the questions around that time.
Yeah, look, it was Carl was a great guy. You know, obviously he was the screenwriter of Detroit Rock City, which I guess does divide a lot of fans, you know. But, you know, he was a lovely person, you know. He was very open and honest about it, you know, and I wish him all the best, you know. I think he did a great job with what he had to do, you know. It's, when you read the interview, it's basically he was a fan who just, you know, got to live his dream of, you know, writing a screenplay about Kiss and had it come true, you know, got it produced. So it's, in some ways, that's another, like, ultimate fan sort of fantasy.
Oh, hey, you're still here, watching or listening. Why don't you hit that subscribe button or click the like one? And if you want even more, click on the join button on YouTube. Thanks for your support. Yeah, you know, the Godspell section really jumped out at me as one of particular interest. It's great to see those elements kind of get illuminated a bit more because they fall by the wayside. A lot of these connections, you know, what is your thought on someone like Bill O'Coin? Do you think his background in television and the visual arts made it just obvious to be taking that route with a very visual and theatrical band like Kiss to get them on TV, to get them to do a movie of some description? The result doesn't matter, but to get them to do a movie.
Yeah, no, I think his background definitely would have been highly influential in, if not consciously, then I think just subconsciously, you know, not just in terms of if that's what he was sort of thinking, but also, you know, it's just natural that most of his contacts would also be in TV and television. So that's probably where, you know, a lot of his leads went and a lot of his opportunities to help promote the band. I mean, it'd be hard to see Kiss on the Mike Douglas show, you know, under another manager perhaps, you know, on daytime television. You know, and I think there's definitely like a flamboyance to Bill as well in terms of he's just got the look of, you know, the television exec rather than the music sort of mogul when I see him, you know. So, yeah, I think he was definitely like a big part. And obviously I think Gene, you know, probably influenced him in that regard as well and probably egged him on, no doubt. You know, I'm sure they're all like Gene, Paul and Bill were all like equal partners in the direction that they took in terms of like, you know, what they agreed to.
But it does seem that a lot of the exploitation or Kissploitation really hinges on Gene's image rather than any of the other threes. It's the demon seems to lend himself more to being interpreted for those evil or malign roles much more than a lover or a kitty cat or a space cadet.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, whenever you see these shows, like, you know, you mentioned the Chips episode or, you know, you know, that porn film I mentioned, Devil Insider, you know, the makeup's always an obvious riff on Gene's, you know, the Scooby-Doo villain, the diabolical disc demon, it's obviously, you know, Gene's makeup. So very few times, I know there's an episode of The Simpsons where you see Ralph Wiggum wearing Peter Criss makeup. So, you know, it really sticks out when something different where it's not Gene Simmons comes up. You know, it's either just Gene or it's all four of them, like you might see in, say, you know, an animated series or something that they may have appeared in.
Yeah, thanks for the reminder about Ralph Wiggum. That's one of my favorites. We still have people on the FAQ message board who use that as their avatar. the cover art of the book, who did that cover art? Because it's absolutely spectacular. I'll punch it in so that people can see a clear copy of it.
Yeah, no, the cover's fantastic. I'm really happy with it. It's done by a local artist called Peter Savieri, who I've sort of known for a few years, and he was a good friend of Lee Gambin. So we're sort of mutual friends of Lee's, and I know Lee was like pushing me when I was talking about, you know, looking for an artist to do the cover for the book. Lee was saying, oh, talk to Peter. He's a great artist. And kind of like kept going, yeah, I'll get to it, you know. And then one day I think Lee posted a photo on his Facebook of an illustration Peter had done of Miss Piggy from The Muppets, but as Carrie from the movie Carrie, the Stephen King, Brian De Palma film. And it was just something about the style. And Peter has done like work for a couple of the Muppets movies, so he's a big like Muppets fan. And there was just something about the style and the colours of it and the way the illustration spoke to me. I was like, wow, you know, Lee's right. This guy really is good. So, you know, just contacted him and we had a few meetings. You know, the basic idea for the art, just to show the band from behind with like the bank of TVs and then put, you know, a different image from a different sort of piece of kissploitation in each screen, I sort of came up with, and Peter just like, you know, brought it to life brilliantly. And, you know, he started doing some other work now on doing Blu-ray slip covers for, you know, limited edition Blu-ray releases. He recently did like the release of Exorcist 2 The Heretic for the Arrow Film Blu-ray release in the UK. So probably the best thing about the whole movie was his art for Exorcist 2. But no, very happy with his cover. You know, I think it's sensational. And, you know, I think it was the right way to go in terms of, you know, protecting yourself, and also just in terms of, you know, putting the focus on the other work in the book, you know, the films that perhaps Kiss themselves weren't a part of, but were clearly influenced by, clearly an influence on.
Well, it's quite a weighty, heavy tome. It's a girthy book. How did you limit the scope, and did you limit the scope? Is what has been published exactly as you envisaged as you started organizing yourself and approaching different topics? Did you have to edit yourself and start axing sections to make it more reasonable from the commercial sense? Because the commercial always collides with the creative when it comes to books of this sort. Yeah, that's the question. Did you have to limit yourself? Were there additional areas that you'd hoped to explore that you just had to let go in the end and leave for another day?
Not really. What was published is pretty much, you know, what I wrote and what I set out to write. I mean, when I submitted it and you know, the editor got back to me and said, oh, you know, this is going to be, it was initially going to be around 900 pages, they said. And I was like, well, so they started asking. It honestly didn't... I just sort of wrote the book and sent it to them. You know, I really didn't think about how big it's going to be when it comes out. So initially they were saying, you know, do you want to think about maybe publishing it in like two sections, like, you know, a part A and a part B with different covers? And part of me thought, you know, that sounds sort of cool, especially like, you know, as Kiss do that sort of gimmick a lot, you know, with different covers and different editions. But, you know, I really just wanted it as like a, you know, a one book thing, like a one volume thing. You know, I knew the book was going to be pretty pricey for what it is. I didn't want people feeling like they're going to have to buy two of them or buy another one at some point. You know, I just wanted to have it done. So what we decided to do was basically, change some illustration size. And I just basically cut down the index. The original index itself was like nearly 84 pages. So I just cut the index down to just the bare basics, just of movie titles and, you know, music video titles. So, yeah, so I got it down to, I think with these things, if you can keep it under 700 pages, from what I understand with these like print-on-demand companies that print sort of worldwide on demand, if you can keep the project to under 700 pages, it just maximizes the number of places that are able to, like, print and distribute the book. So kind of makes sense from that point of view as well.
Yeah, that's a very important logistical issue with print-on-demand, is not all print shops are created equally, so you need the common denominator between them all in order to get the maximize your audience. But I think what the greatest thing about this is it's a single-point reference to Kiss's, you know, screen experience, and it's not been an area that's been touched on by multiple people in multiple ways, multiple times over the years. So that makes it very refreshing. How has the reception been to it from your perspective, and is it meeting your expectations? And are you happy with the, I mean, it's early days, obviously, but are you happy so far with the response from the Kiss fan communities in various places?
Yeah, look, I mean, I knew going into, I've written sort of, books in the past, but none of them have been on such a, you know, a well-known or divisive subject as KISS. So, you know, going into it, I knew that, you know, the book's not going to please everyone. It's not going to please every KISS fan. So I was never going to try and do that. You know, I wanted to steer clear of any, you know, controversies or things like that, like, you know, any leaks and things like that that have happened in terms of, you know, video material. I just wanted to be purely about the work. It's kind of like weird because you work on it for so long and you have it in your head for so long and you edit and you proofread and, you know, you go over it over and over again until you think you're happy with it and you think it's as good as can be and then you're all confident. But then as soon as you hit the send button, you know, suddenly it goes from being all in your head to being out there for the whole world to see, and suddenly your confidence is like, whoop, what have I just done? I felt like what Paul said in his book when he first you know, went past the record store and saw the poster for The Elder in the window, and, you know, his whole sort of just sunk, like, what have I done? But, you know, but thankfully, you know, and now I've been getting really good, you know, feedback from it. You know, I haven't heard anything negative at this point. You know, everyone seems really happy with it, and sales seem to have been pretty good. You know, it's been doing pretty well on Amazon, and, you know, people have been sending me photos of their copy of the book, you know, sitting on their KISS pinball machines and things like that. So, you know, that's good to see. You know, you don't write a book like this to become rich. You know, I do it for the love of it, and because I wanted to create like a good resource for KISS fans, and as you said, I wanted to do something that hasn't been covered to death before. You know, there's been so many books about KISS written, and there has been a couple of books written specifically just about Phantom of the Park. You know, there was that Conversations with Phantoms book that Bear Manor themselves put out a few years ago, a slim sort of book of interviews, and there was a great sort of full colour guide to Phantom of the Park that is it Elaine over in France puts out, which was really good, but nothing that's
yeah, the yeah whole that, Elaine in Japan,
sorry, yeah, that's a beautiful you know, publication, and obviously even some of your own KISS books like Mask Hysteria and the solo albums and Odyssey, along with Elaine's books, you know, they were really instrumental in me, you know, deciding to go ahead with Creatures of the Screen in terms of like showing me, you know, what you can do with an unauthorized sort of KISS book. So, and the FAQ was also
what you could do without a publisher. I mean, I think the key to people like myself and Elaine in particular is that we're not aligned with traditional publishing houses for our unauthorized works. So it gives you a scope and a freedom. It's also very dangerous in other ways to do certain things. But it allows you so much freedom of exploration of the topic, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's so addicting, because there's always more topics of interest.
When I was working on the book, I did sort of talk to like people that had authors and publishers that have both put out, you know, official and unauthorized books and projects on KISS, and, you know, got all their feedback, and, you know, the general consensus from most of them was if you can go unauthorized, do it. You'll save yourself so much headache and have so much more freedom.
Well, yeah, because once you take out the contract and the proper publishing house and all the legal side, you know, that it takes to take a book through the proper shopping process, it becomes a lot easier to not have those. I'm going to call them what they are: roadblocks and delays. You know, you want to focus on your art, and that's the creator. You know, and exploring the topic and the subject without worrying about all the other side of things, which really needs to come with a couple of aspirins. Mm-hmm. But as Doc McGee would say, it's all part of the process. What is next? What is next for you creatively? Where do you go from here? And where are you at today in 2025 as a KISS fan? The band has been off the road for a couple of years. We're coming out of a drought of information and exposure and them actually doing anything. You know, where is John today as a KISS fan?
Yeah, look, I mean, I enjoy keeping up with them. You know, it does seem a bit weird, you know, not knowing that there's a KISS album, a KISS tour on the horizon. It was something that you get so used to over 50 years, you know, just them planning another tour and, you know, just wonder what they're going to wear and, you know, are they going to change the set list? You know, we're never going to see that again, apart from, you know, maybe when they do these one-off Vegas events and such. So, you know, I mean, look, my fandom's pretty much just where it always was. You know, they're my favorite band. They're not the only band I listen to, but, you know, most of my favorite bands are long gone now, you know, so I never got the chance to even experience a lot of them, like, you know, the Doors and the Beatles, you know, they were just, you know, just all in my head, basically. You know, at least Kiss, even after 1980, there was like a 15-year gap before they came out to Australia again because no one would really touch them. That's how much the Kisteria sort of bubble had burst. You know, so that was like a really long gap between drinks, you know, 15 years to thinking, oh, I'll probably never see him again, you know. And then certainly in that time, you know, they're more than made up for it with some, you know, great tours, like multiple tours, you know. And I've been lucky enough to see him 13 times now, which I think is the appropriate number to end on for me. You know, my first concert was the very first Melbourne Kiss concert at VFL Park in 1980, which was a, you know, an amazing experience on a stinking hot day. So certainly that's, you know, as your first rock show, that's certainly one to remember and one to put in your books, you know. And then the last time I saw them was one of the second of the three end of the road shows they did in Melbourne in 2022. You know, one of my friends, his daughter got to be one of the dancers when they came out here to do the grand final in 2023. So that was pretty exciting. And I interviewed him for the book as well. It was a big thrill for him to see his daughter wearing Catman makeup, dancing on the field with Kiss before the big grand final, as you can imagine. And that was another aspect of the book that I sort of wanted to cover, was their, you know, TV sporting appearances. In terms of my future, I don't know, you know, I've always got like a few ideas, but, you know, with the new book, Creatures of the Screen, still sort of fairly fresh, I'll just concentrate on enjoying that and looking at, being asked to do like a few, you know, signings and that, and potentially do like a bit of a book launch and have a bit of a clip and tell where I'll show some of my favorite sort of moments from Kissploitation, and, we'll do that at a cinema near me. So that'll be exciting. Then, yeah, I've got a few sort of other book ideas put aside, which I'll focus on in time. And the thing with getting older is when you're in your 20s and 30s, you can have so many ideas in your head and you just sort of put them away and go, okay, I'll get to that one day. And but, you know, eventually you start to think, well, you know, all those ideas, I'm not going to be able to get to all of them. You know, you've got to try and weed through them and decide which ones are really important or the most important to you to get out, you know. But that's always easier said than done as well, because sometimes the project that might be most important to you, you may not be in that space where you really are ready to write about it then and there. You know, you've also got to be like properly inspired to get into it. But, you know, I'll see what my next subject will be.
We all have life going on in the background as well to creating. I mean, very few get to create full time, and that is their gig. The rest of us have bills to pay, and, you know, these things take secondary importance. I find with my works, when I look at them after publishing them and the initial feedbacks come in, that I can always look over at a book and be particularly warm about one part about it. What is your warmest thought about Creatures of the Screen as you look at that book now in print, realized that what has started as an idea and become a passion has been brought to fruition and you're holding it in your hand? What is that happy thought that you get looking at Creatures of the Screen?
I think, you know, part of it's an overall feeling of, you know, wow, you know, at one stage I was like just a small fry little Kiss fan, you know. Now I've come full circle and come to this, you know, and a couple of my like old school friends have been in touch with me saying, man, you know, I can't believe it, you know, you're always such a huge Kiss fan at school, you know, now you've written a book about them. But I think in terms of like personally, maybe just reading the introduction and, you know, the way that sort of brings me back to that night in, you know, 1976, and not just because it was, you know, my first experience of Kiss and that's a magic moment, but just, you know, with hindsight, you know, it's a time when, you know, my family was still alive. You know, my parents are no longer here. You know, my older brother's no longer here. And so much shit has gone on, you know, so much life. So just thinking back to that time, you know, and just, you know, reading about the whole hysteria section in 1980 and, you know, when I was reading and writing about Norman Gunston singing his I Am Marching in the Kids Army song and Kiss being on the Don Lane show as the prize guest, you know, it's a warm feeling because it brings back not just great memories of a great time being a Kiss fan, but just watching all that stuff with your parents and your older brothers and sisters in the lounge room and, you know, just that sense of, you know, family. And, you know, reading those sections of the book really bring that back to me, and that's a nice feeling.
Yeah, Norman seems to, from an outsider, seems to be a particularly Australian ingredient there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen any of his other interviews, but he's done some absolutely brilliant ones. You know, a lot of people will sort of be a bit puzzled initially, but then they'll sort of get, you know, what he's on about and go with the flow. And then others are just totally, you know, totally bamboozled and don't know what to make of him. And then there's others like if you look it up on YouTube where he tries to interview Keith Moon from The Who, and Moon just basically tells him to piss off, you bloody Australian puffed up. So, yeah, Keith Moon just wouldn't have a bar of it. But, you know, Norman, he did sort of push Gene a little bit where he made a reference in his questions at the press conference to Diana Ross and her skin colour, you know, which is a very touchy subject, even at the time, you know, let alone today. But, you know, I think they sort of warmed to him eventually when you watch the press conference. And
well, I think the 1980 press conference was a hell of a lot better than the 1997 one. Let's put it that way, yeah. Because one was actually funny, and the other one showed the other side of where the media had kind of gone into the mean, or it was trying to be too edgy and it didn't work. Clearly, it clicked a bit more in 1980. John, it's great to talk to an Australian Kiss fan who became a fan before 1980. That I didn't know. Just to know that there were fans of Kiss before Kisteria in Australia. I think you could be very proud of Creatures of the Screen. I wish you the very best of success with it. I hope you get to do plenty more podcast appearances on the other Kiss shows to talk more about the book, the creative process, and other aspects that I haven't had time to touch on today. But it's been absolutely wonderful to meet you, and I do thank you for staying up for this interview.
My pleasure, Julian, and thanks again to the FAQ because they did contribute quite a bit to the book. There was like one particular topic that's on the board, post your Kiss sightings in film and TV shows here, and that ended up being a terrific resource for me. So I'm sure there's still plenty out there that I'm missing that'll pop up in a future expanded edition. But, yeah, thanks to the FAQ for their input there. Much appreciated.
There's always more, but for now, that's the show. Check out Creatures of the Screen wherever quality books are sold, but start your search on Amazon or go to, let's make sure I get it right,
Manamedia, that's correct, .com.
Don't buy glasses on. There we go. Thank you for spending time listening to the Kiss FAQ podcast today. All sales are final. There are no refunds. If you'd like, look us up on Facebook or come over to the message board and discuss the topics we've broadcast today. Don't forget to hit subscribe wherever you've listened to this show, and a like would very much be appreciated. We hope you'll join us again, but until then, remember, life's a radio. Turn it up to 10.